remember seeing the military on my fourth day while I was there in Larkana. That's not to say that they were not there, but that was the day that they were most visible, and that was when the clouds had cleared a bit and the rain had gone away. The military was much more active in 2010, which was another record-breaking flood. These floods have, of course, broken that record as well. And that flood in 2010, as catastrophic as it was actually easier to manage because it was primarily glacial melt. So you could predict where the water was coming from as it flowed north to south to the Arabian Sea. In this case, it's not the same. We have glacial melt actually happened after rainfall. So the scope was really overwhelming. Now, you mentioned the government. People are extremely angry at the government, especially in the province of Sindh, especially in the province of Balochistan, where they don't feel that their representatives are actually their representatives. Many people in Pakistan, our democratic system is unfortunately quite faulty. People are intimidated into voting for ruling parties, and people who have voted for these parties are not seeing their representatives. So people are being very vocally angry and against them. In terms of NGOs, there is definitely a very large presence of NGOs, but they themselves are spread very thin. You have organizations such as Legal Aid Society, which is in fact what it says, a legal aid society, is going from legal work to going on boats and distributing rations or food to people who cannot be accessed. And there's also a law in Pakistan which limits NGOs and has actually banned several NGOs. So a lot of NGOs that might be able to take up the labor of doing this have not been able
to. It may shock people to know that there's more glacial ice, more glaciers in Pakistan than any place on Earth outside of the polar region. And in 10 seconds, Zulfikar, if you could comment on your being critical of the IMF for bankrolling massive dams and barrages that have broken during this flooding.
You know, as you said, the glaciers are Pakistan's water storage, and there's been this idea that water should not go to the sea. But what happens when water does not go to the sea is that it does not reach the people of the sea. And the first climate refugees in Pakistan were, in fact, those in the 1960s who had to flee the delta when dried, when the IMF built a Kotri barrage. So the IMF has been responsible for a
Zulfikar
great deal of our
work. We have to end it there. I thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Portland's favorite talk radio at 8 on Fridays returns at 8 on Friday, September 16th. Tammy and Althea are back to bring you thoughtful insights, colorful commentary, activist interviews, and community conversation. Minding it, bridging it, filling it in. The Gap returns to KBOO on Friday, September 16th at 8 a.m.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio, a production of the Coast Range Association. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. I'm so excited to bring you this conversation today with Oregon Wild's Forest Climate Policy Coordinator, Lauren Anderson. Lauren joined Oregon Wild in 2020 after several years in Washington, D.C., working on energy, climate, and wildlife policy issues. Among other roles, Lauren helps coordinate the Climate Forest Campaign, a coalition of environmental organizations across the country working to protect mature and old-growth forests. The Coast Range Association is a proud partner in that campaign, and I hope you feel as inspired to take action as I was after this conversation. If you like what you hear, you can find all our shows and more at coastrange.org. We're also on all the podcast apps at Coast Range Radio, and we'd be grateful if you'd subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review. And if you're listening on your community radio stations, thank you so much and make sure to support them. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future shows and guests, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Okay, Lauren Anderson, welcome to Coast Range Radio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here to talk with you today.
You have engaged in a lot of projects that I'm super interested in and would love to talk with you about. And I hope we can cover a lot of ground today, but I think your biggest focus currently is on the Climate Forests campaign. I was thinking we could start there. Could you give us the elevator pitch for what the Climate Forest campaign is, and then we can dig a little more into some of the details and various aspects of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. So when we think about forest and climate issues, they span such a wide range of topics. Logging impacts clean water, it's related to the threat of wildfire. And then we have different ownership types. We have private lands, which are a really big challenge in Oregon in terms of logging practices, and state forest lands, which are also not managed as well. And then we also have federal lands, and that is really the focus of the Climate Forest campaign. So this campaign is very narrowly focused on ending mature and old growth logging on federal lands. So that's Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands. I'm very focused on the Pacific Northwest. So I work with organizations across Oregon, Washington, California, to really help coordinate and drive the campaign efforts regionally. But those efforts are definitely connected to a national campaign.
Yeah, well, that might be a good place to talk about where the campaign started or the connection to President Biden's executive order around conserving forests. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as many folks know, efforts to protect mature and old growth forests on federal land stretch back decades. So this is really the most recent iteration of a campaign that goes back a very long ways, with many people working on it over the years. We all came together under one banner, the Climate Forest Campaign, to officially launch this campaign. Little did we know that 2 months later, after launching the campaign, come Earth Day, President Biden issued an executive order protecting mature and old growth forests, or calling for their protection. Doesn't officially protect them from out the gate, but he's calling for their protections, which is a pretty big deal. And this was a huge deal for a couple reasons. One, because it talks about mature forests as well as old growth, which is a first. And it talks about Bureau of Land Management lands in addition to national Forest Service lands. So those are both really big steps forward, and we're pretty excited about it.
Right, absolutely. The Climate Forest campaign, you all recently successfully coordinated, among dozens of groups to get over 120,000 comments submitted to the USDA during the Forest Service's public comment period on defining mature and old growth forests in service of enacting President Biden's executive order.
So thank you. It was definitely a group effort. Organizations across the country really came together to drive that comment count and get in that guidance to the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. Following the executive order, when it came out on Earth Day, it was followed, I believe in June, by a secretarial memo that came out from Secretary Vilsack with the USDA. I would say that memo did not have a lot of very helpful detail in determining where they were going in terms of next steps of implementing the executive order. But there was one piece in there that was glaringly obvious about an opinion that they held on these issues. And that opinion was that logging was no longer a threat to mature and old growth forests, that these forests are adequately protected. There are no ongoing threats. Logging is not a thing we have to worry about. It's all about wildfire and climate change, and we don't need to worry about it. And that is obviously not true. We have numerous projects here in Oregon alone where there is still mature and old growth logging happening, including Flat Country, and several Bureau of Land Management projects as well, and projects in Eastern Oregon. And so we were really focused on a couple of things. One, highlighting logging is in fact a threat to mature and old growth, and that the Forest Service can't ignore that. And two, that whatever policy is developed coming out of this effort needs to be focused on a durable, lasting protection for these trees.
Yeah. You know, just so I'm making sure that I'm understanding it, you know, President Biden came out and said, we are going to protect mature and old growth forests as part of our conservation goals, but that can mean a lot of different things. So then it's up to the Secretary of the Interior and then the USDA and Forest Service to decide, okay, what counts here? How are we going to inventory it? Blah, 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 blah. And that's where you all came in to make sure that we get the strongest possible implementation and definition of these policies.
Absolutely. So what we're pretty sure the Forest Service would prefer to focus on as part of this exercise is wildfire. And the only way to protect mature and old growth forests from the threat of wildfire is to thin and log them extensively so that, you know, there are no more forests to burn, which is a, you know, I have some issues with that strategy for a variety of reasons. But the reality is it's not the dominant threat to these forests. Mature and old growth forests are some of the most resistant to wildfires. They had thicker bark, higher tree canopies, and are better able to withstand the impacts of climate change. And so we really need to make sure that whatever comes out of this process around the executive order really does address the threat of logging and ensures that whatever the Forest Service wants to focus on in terms of restoring ecological function in certain areas, that it still, no matter what, removes this option of logging mature and old growth trees. So that is not something the agencies are on board with, and it's something that we really need to make sure remains a priority. We need to make sure that what we have left is protected and that we protect enough mature forests that we're actually able to ensure at the end of the day that old growth forests are, they begin to grow back across the country. And I will say one last point that we really want to focus on. When people think of climate solutions, they think of, you know, wind turbines and solar panels and Teslas and, you know, all these different things pop into your mind when you think like fighting climate change. And we want old growth trees to be in people's minds as well, so that they begin to value them for climate change the same way those other solutions are valued.
Absolutely. It's just a shocking fact that in Oregon, our number one source of carbon emissions is the logging industry. And it's just absolutely untrue that these short rotation timber plantations are net carbon sinks. The real net carbon sinks, like you say, are these mature and old growth forests.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible where we live. I mean, our temperate rainforests have more carbon per acre in this region than the Amazon rainforest. And the fact that, you know, we have this climate solution at our fingertips that is like, doesn't cost us any money to build. All we have to do is just let these trees grow and ensure that they're still standing for future generations. And it really is simple and cost effective. And in my mind is really just kind of the low hanging fruit of things that we could do. And we don't have any technologies yet that can really pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at scale. And we have a solution that's here now and does not cost millions of dollars. So we should probably use it.
Exactly. I wonder if you could talk at all about the forests that you all are highlighting as forests that are currently being threatened with logging and should not be logged. And maybe especially the ones here in Oregon and how folks can like get involved with protecting those specific forests.
Yeah, absolutely. So those 10 projects are definitely, first off, not a comprehensive list of all of the mature and old growth forests across the entire country. Those examples were pulled because of the variety they offered. Some of them, like the Vermont project, isn't necessarily logging old growth forests, but it is targeting a very big area of mature forests. So East Coast has like practically no old growth left. So the fact that they're still targeting and logging mature forests in like North Carolina and Vermont is just terrible, because that pretty much eliminates any chance we have of getting old growth back on the East Coast. And then it also, that report highlights a wide array of the sorts of project types that people do. Like flat country in Oregon is just a straight up old school, old growth logging project where their rationale for it is getting timber volume. That's why they're after flat country. is because they can get a ton of timber volume cheaply.
And just to jump in, sorry, when you say the flat country timber sale, for folks that maybe have no idea, that's, you know, like, where is that?
Pretty much east of Eugene in Willamette National Forest. And it's a beautiful area, very pristine, huge old trees. The other types of projects that we're highlighting, like in Montana, some of the projects that they're doing are for wildfire resilience. So they're saying, you know, we need to go in and log this old growth forest in order to reduce wildfire risk. And so it just kind of gives sort of the overview of all of the different arguments the Forest Service uses for continuing to log mature and old growth forests. And so there's a wide variety out there, wide geographic distribution. And that's what we tried to highlight specifically with the report.
Where can people, you know, see the report for themselves? Where can people get more information about these forests we're highlighting and just the Climate Forest campaign in general?
One of the best places to get these resources is through the Climate Forest website. The website has an overview of the campaign, summary of news coverage, has the Worth More Standing report on there, along with a bunch of blogs that members of the campaign have written. There's also a contact form on the website.
Yeah, and so that website, though, is climate-forests.org.
Yep.
And there's that little hyphen in there, climate-forests.org.
Yep. And you can also just Google climate forest and it should be the first thing that shows up for you as well.
Yeah. And again, I just think that the threatened forests piece, which if you go to climateforest.org, it's one of the headline tabs at the top of the page. And I think you all did a really good job of picking, like you say, a broad range of forests over a broad range of the country that showcase important and worthy conservation efforts everywhere. So definitely recommend that folks check that out. So what are the next steps for this campaign?
What we're hoping for coming out of this comment period is a summary and key takeaways that the Forest Service got. And obviously the messages that we want them to take away is that they need to develop meaningful new policy. It's not enough to just update some forest plans or continue with business as usual. We need something that's actually pretty transformative in terms of a policy solution. And then we also need to ensure that logging is addressed as a threat. It's not all about wildfire. There are commercial logging projects that are continuing to take big old trees from the landscape, and we need to put an end to that. The next big milestone looking forward is COP27. So that's the next big international climate change conference, which will be happening in Egypt this year. And our hope is that we get some more updated big announcements around how the U.S. is planning to use forests as a climate solution going forward. That was one of the big announcements that Biden made at last year's International Climate Conference. And obviously a lot has happened this year. So we're hoping for some more updates this November. And our time and energy will be focused on basically doing everything that we can to ensure that we get some sort of meaningful announcement out of COP27.
Right. You know, for better and for worse, the U.S. is a world leader. And it's really important that we go into these, you know, international conferences, having done the work at home, you know, especially when we go ask other countries like Brazil or, you know, countries without our economic power to be conserving their own forests and their own resources, that we're walking the walk as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel, and I think that the U.S. often goes into those sorts of international meetings acting as if all of our issues are already solved here in the U.S., when the reality is that, you know, old growth is still at risk in the United States, and we have such a deficit that it's not only about protecting the old growth we have, but also about recovering it. And it rings a little hollow when the United States basically points the finger at other countries when we're not walking the walk ourselves.
I'd love to pivot now, and since we're talking about, you know, federal policy and the U.S. government walking the walk internationally, I'd love to get your take on the recent historic climate bill that Democrats just passed, and more broadly about how you feel about some of the tensions between electoral and non-electoral organizing. I was really frustrated to see some of our allies kind of trashing and dismissing the bill. And for anybody that doesn't know, it's the, I'm talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, but what it really is above all else is the, you know, biggest climate investment in world history. And I think really we should be taking the win here. You know, people have organized for years and years, and I really think of this as a win, despite, you know, obviously some bad things in there.
Yeah. And I mean, the sort of issues and challenges that you raise around climate policy are like a very big can of worms in terms of just like the complexities, and like it's deeply tied into people's emotions and values around these topics. And I am extremely sympathetic to the people that were frustrated with the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, climate change is like the greatest challenge of our time, and we want our elected leaders to rise to the occasion and meet the challenge sort of on the scale that it needs to be met on. And, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that the IRA does not do that. What it is the biggest climate bill, the only really major climate bill the United States has ever passed, and potentially one of the biggest pieces of climate policy that's ever been done in the world. It is a transformative piece of policy. When you talk about climate policy, there's kind of two camps of people. There are the people that want to put a price on carbon, like a carbon tax or a cap and trade program, and that restricts emissions and is kind of a top-down approach to ensuring that polluting technologies cost more money and therefore they're not desirable in the future. And then the other side of things is very much a growth focused path. So folks that are focused on incentivizing clean energy, building out the good, not necessarily, you know, punishing polluters. And the Inflation Reduction Act is definitely the latter. So this strategy is focused on growth, jobs. It's focused on building out electric vehicle infrastructure and solar and wind and zero emissions technologies. It is very much a different way of looking at things than a lot of traditional climate policy has been. So it's also going to take a long time, which is obviously frustrating when you're like, I want every fossil fuel terminal shut down. We need to stop building natural gas plants. Like, why are we still mining coal? This is ridiculous. This is basically shifting the U.S. economy to be more focused on clean energy in the future. And so that's kind of an overview of like the strategy behind this bill and why it matters and how it's going to be transformative.
I agree with your assessment. You know, obviously it's not everything it should be if we could wave a magic wand and get the policy that's needed. And this doesn't contradict your point at all, but these things don't happen in a vacuum. You know, they happen in the realm of what is politically possible in a specific moment. And I think that is where my frustration comes in, is we do have a very closely divided political environment. And whatever you out there think, I encourage you to vote. But I think it's, you know, it's worth noting that we have razor thin margins in both houses of Congress. And we have a, you know, a Democratic Party that has become more and more unified around the need for big climate action, and a Republican Party that, I mean, I don't know what to say.
not much in the way of a positive spin you can put on the Republican Party and climate policy. So
right,
that's understandable.
Yeah. So that, I guess that's where my starting point is, that the world of what is possible changes depending on who's in power. And so I think that's also an important framing to look at it. But, you know, how do you think about that tension between, you know, pushing for wins in the politically possible of the moment versus pushing for what is right and what is necessary, even if it isn't politically possible or popular?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I will answer it real quick, though. I want to acknowledge in terms of the IRA specifically, I think it's also really good to acknowledge there are all these other associated values that are woven in very deeply and intrinsically with climate policy, including environmental justice, access to like affordable housing, all of these other pieces that come in, and including conservation, that is also a very deep part of that. And a lot of that was lost from the bill as it made it over the finish line. I think when you hear about people's frustrations about the bill, it was because all of those like wildlife conservation values and investments were lost. And a lot of the, you know, there are aspects of environmental justice that were woven into the final bill, but not as much as there was originally. And so there are a lot of legitimate frustrations associated with the bill, especially on forestry issues, I will say, and fuels reduction money.
Yeah.
You know, it is good to acknowledge that in addition to being one of the biggest and best climate bills that we have ever seen, it also did a little bit of damage to us. So it's good to be open about that.
Oh, absolutely.
But pivoting back to sort of your question, I think, so my formative years in getting into climate policy and advocacy, I went to Oregon State University for graduate school, got a master's of public policy from their program, and was determined to never leave Oregon again. So were a lot of other people who want to work on environmental issues. And so I eventually gave up and moved to DC for what I thought was going to be the start of the next Clinton administration. But that was not the case. I spent the next 4 years in DC working for the National Wildlife Federation during the Trump years. And so
Wow, you were in the trenches.
My formative years were and my rosy outlook on what is possible was definitely kind of a different take, I think, than what a lot of people who get into this work start out with. So because of sort of my start in this path, I am definitely of the take where whatever we can get done, whatever progress we can make needs to be made. And then once you make that progress, then you go on to the next thing instead of sacrificing wins in the quest for like the perfect solution. So I'm pretty firmly rooted in that outlook on life. That being said, though, I do think there are times where it's good to just, you know, stake your flag and fight for what is right and what you believe in. So, and I think that groups that do that and people that do that ultimately push the conversation further than it would have gone otherwise. So I think there's a lot of value in both views on life, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I try to embody both of those viewpoints to, you know, different degrees at different times, but that can be a really hard tension to hold and balance. But actually, you just kind of touched on a piece of this conversation that I wanted to get to. So maybe this is a great time. I want to hear more about your origin story. Like how did you come to this work? How did you come to care about it in the first place?
So I grew up in California and I grew up sort of camping and backpacking. My dad was a scientist. And so I had always, you know, been fully committed to being a marine biologist when I grew up. And then I realized I was scared of the ocean, so gave up on that. I ended up at Oregon State University working in climate policy during graduate school and discovered a lot of interest for it, actually. And so, like I said earlier, I was determined to stay in Oregon forever and never leave. And I, you know, everyone who wants to work on environmental issues wants to live in a beautiful state. Right. And you know, you go to job fairs and there's like hundreds of people and competition's pretty steep. And all I had on my resume was wildlife biology stuff. So I intended it to be a 6-month trip to DC to get some more experience and then turn around and come back, and turned into 4 years. And so I was lucky enough to get this job offer with Oregon Wild, and the rest is history. It's been the best choice I think I could have made. I've been so happy and the work has been so interesting, and the people at Oregon Wild, as I'm sure you know, are pretty fantastic to work with.
Sounds like you have had the opportunity to work kind of in a lot of different contexts, and I think that's really just beneficial for somebody to have that kind of diverse experience. I find people who are able to work in DC find that really fascinating, because that seems like almost like an alien world to me.
I mean, yeah, it was a weird time for sure to be in DC because we were, you know, we would have our signs tucked under our desks in the office, and then everyone would get the notification after work that there was another rally in front of the White House, or there was another rally in front of Congress, and we'd all grab whatever sign fit the issue best and run out the door to go to the rally after work. And, you know, we had our polar bear costumes on, like stashed under the desk, and just like, that was like every week there was something new to run out there and protest. And so in some ways it was nice being in kind of the epicenter of it all, because you were all in it together, and it didn't feel like you were far away and helpless or anything like that. It felt like you were deeply connected and involved in the fight against it all. So that was good. But it definitely can lead to a little bit of burnout there at the end for sure.
Well, so finally, is there anything I've missed today or anything that you want to add to the conversation?
You know, our conversation today was very focused on federal lands and the Climate Forest Campaign, which is the vast amount of my time. But there are a bunch of other issues related to private lands and state lands in Oregon. So I absolutely encourage people to get plugged into those issues, attend Board of Forestry meetings. They're all public access. And if folks want to get engaged, there are a great number of ways to do so. My email, if you want to reach out and get involved, is la@oregonwild.org. So please feel free to reach out. You can also get in touch with our campaign organizer, Victoria. Her email is bw@oregonwild.org. Just Google Climate Forest, or the URL is climate-forest. And it is a great way to learn more about the campaign, and you can reach out directly to us through that website as well. So I really hope folks get involved going forward.
Well, Lauren Anderson, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you so much for all the hard work that you do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
And that's our show. One last time, that website is climate-forests.org. You can also find all of our shows and more at coastrange.org. And like I said at the top of the show, we're also on all the podcast apps. Please remember to subscribe and leave us a review. Any feedback or suggestions, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you soon.
Try to put in at least 5 or 6 hours at cable, right? Because we're
the Fire Sign Theater.
So listen to 90.7 FM for...
Hello, and welcome to Coast Range Radio, a production of the Coast Range Association. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. On the show today, we're diving into the exciting and choppy waters of offshore wind. Floating offshore wind energy is a relatively new technology with huge potential. The Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management estimates up to 3 gigawatts in near-term commercial potential off the Oregon coast alone. That's enough to power over 200,000 homes. I'm really excited for today's topic, because I feel like it encapsulates a lot of the complexity and messiness around what it looks like to actually transition quickly away from fossil fuels. How do we move with the speed necessary to scale into a post-carbon energy society without creating unnecessary and unforeseen collateral damage? What is the real economic and energy potential of projects like this, and what level of ecological disturbance is acceptable in the name of rapid decarbonization? To explore these questions, I'm joined by two guests, Joe Liebezeit and Shannon Souza. Joe Liebezeit has worked for Portland Audubon since 2013 as a staff scientist and leads Audubon's community science and coastal conservation programs. And full disclosure, Joe and I work together as part of the Oregon Marine Reserves Partnership. Shannon Souza is policy director for Pacific Ocean Energy Trust, co-founder of Oregon Coast Energy Alliance Network, and owns Soul Coast Companies, a renewable energy design, construction, and consulting business based in Coos Bay. Shannon and Joe, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Shannon, I'd like to start with you. Could you describe what we're talking about here? What is a floating offshore wind farm or facility, and where are we looking at in terms of sites?
Sure. A floating wind turbine, most of the listeners, I'm sure, have seen the large land-based terrestrial turbines that we have inland. So take one of those, and we're going to multiply it by a factor of about 3. These floating turbines are about 900 feet tall. They, as the name suggests, instead of being fixed on the bottom of the ocean floor, because our ocean floor drops off so deeply, so quickly, these will be floating and tethered to the ocean floor. The frequency at which they'll be tethered to the floor is not yet known. They'll definitely be tethered to each other. They're going to be about a mile apart from each other to avoid wind shadowing, and they will be tethered together in some kind of a pattern. So all of this is to be determined, but rapidly coming into better focus. Oregon has a planning goal, not a directive to build, but a planning goal to look at the opportunities and challenges of 3 gigawatts of these turbines. Right now, the turbines are coming off the shelf, off the rack, so to speak, at about 15 megawatts. By the time we have them in our water, they'll be somewhere between 15 and 20 megawatts. What that relates to in terms of square miles of our ocean, if we were to develop 3 gigawatts of floating offshore wind off of our coast, they would take roughly 400 square miles total. Right now, we have 2 areas that have been identified that have good wind potential and may be able to support those 3 gigawatts within them. One of the areas is down south, right off the coast of Brookings, and it runs all the way up to the California border. That's some of the richest wind resource that has been identified on Earth. That is called a call area. And the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management put that call area out for comment, both comments from those of us who live along the coast or use those waters or have potential concerns about ecological impacts within those call areas, and also a call for interest from members of the offshore wind industry to identify areas within the call area that they see as economically viable to develop. So that southern call area right off of Brookings can encompass just over 3 gigawatts. I think it's like 3.5 gigawatts. It's its total footprint. There's another call area that's been identified right off the coast of Coos Bay, so north of that. That's a much larger call area. I don't have that sitting right in front of me now. But at the end of the day, if we add up all of the call areas, we're looking at about 20 to 25% in total that would be required if they were to be developed out into these wind farms. From the wind farm out in the ocean, then the electrons, the electricity from the wind farm, typically comes into shore. And one of the driving reasons for the locations that those call areas have is their proximity to interconnection points on our coastal electricity grid.
So, okay, so you are, as I understand it, an advocate for these projects. Can you make the case to us about, you know, can you make the case for floating offshore wind? And do you have any reservations or concerns about the projects or proposals?
Sure, happy to. I come at this from an energy resilience perspective. With or without a seismic event that our South Coast is also trying to prepare for, we have some of the poorest power quality already in the grid. We're at the end of the grid with low population centers. As our grid continues to grow to respond to all of this electrification of our heating systems, electrification of our transportation sector, population growth in the Pacific Northwest, we are going to see increasing periods of resource inadequacy, meaning we're not producing along the Western grid all of the electricity that all of the demands want at that time. So there are two compelling reasons that got me to start investigating floating offshore wind. One, the entire Western grid is facing resource inadequacy. We need over 300 new gigawatts of clean electrons in the next 20 years. For context, right now, the entire Western grid has about 220. So we need to more than double what we've got. The other side of it is climate. The climate mitigation potential, i.e., let's reduce the greenhouse gas contributions from our energy sector and our transportation sector so that we can at least start to pump the brakes on this unprecedented climate change, if not for our generation, maybe five generations down the road. But more immediate to those of us living today and our kids, as an adaptive measure to provide and develop new resources of clean renewables that are right off of our shores will greatly strengthen our own small little coastal community grid resilience, but also has tremendous grid stabilization for not only the state of Oregon, but the entire Western grid. So it is a delicate balance to figure out with the best of the information that we have now, where should we site these to minimize those conflicts, ecological sensitive species conflicts, and also with our sustainable fishers. How are we going to support this deployment? Which ports are going to be involved, and how will the infrastructure required to support this huge new industry for the entire Pacific, how will that impact the other industries that already are supported by those ports? And how will it impact the really fragile and essential ecosystems that we have specifically in our coastal wetlands? So those are the biggies as I see them and looking at the full swath of potential conflicts and opportunities. Opportunity, a climate imperative for mitigation, adaptation, and coastal energy resilience. And on the flip side, the potential conflicts are with our existing fisheries and our ecosystems, both oceanic and shoreside.
Right. And I want to definitely touch more on striking that balance in a little bit. But first, Joe, I know you aren't exactly bringing the con perspective, but you do have concerns. Could you give us a quick overview of some of the concerns that you have, and then maybe we can go into some of those in more detail?
Sure, and I'll just first start off saying that Portland Audubon, our position on this, is we're wholeheartedly supportive of alternative energy, including floating offshore wind, but we are deeply concerned about this new technology, which really hasn't been used at all in North America and just in a few places in Europe. So it's relatively untested. And it's bringing it to the West Coast is a big new challenge because the California current ecosystem, which has this incredible upwelling of nutrients and supports probably like the fourth or fifth most important ecological area off of any coast in the world, that supports wildlife and also the fisheries, which Shannon touched on. So those are two big concerns for us is again, it's a relatively new technology, and bringing it to kind of the rugged, rough and ecologically important West Coast brings up lots of concerns for us in our organization.
Could you run through some of the specific concerns that you have? And I might have a couple follow-up questions on each.
So our concerns kind of can be broken down into a couple different areas. One of them is just the process that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has put forward. And then we have specific concerns about impacts to wildlife and fish in those call areas. So first, talking about the process, one of our biggest concerns is that the way the process is laid out does not require BOEM to do a cumulative impact analysis across multiple call areas across the whole region. Because of that framework, we are concerned that species that are highly migratory, things like the gray whale, which migrates up and down the West Coast and will be going through multiple different call areas, there is no way right now in the process to understand cumulative impacts to highly migratory species like the gray whale and migratory birds, and also to folks in the fishing industry that may fish in multiple places that would cross the boundaries of those call areas. In our public comment, we have been pushing very strongly for BOEM to do a programmatic EIS or programmatic environmental impact statement, which is kind of a standard thing for these types of projects to be done. There's been a lot of support, not just from the environmental NGO community, but the Coastal Caucus, legislators based on the coast, have also asked for the same thing, as well as Senator Wyden, and pretty much every port along the coast that submitted comments is asking for such a cumulative impacts analysis as well. So it's a concern not just from the NGO community, but pretty much a lot of different groups, including decision makers. Getting to, though, the wildlife impacts, I think, for one, those two call areas that Shannon discussed are very large. They are, if you take the area of them, they're the size of like the state of Delaware. If there's infrastructure built there, it will require, with this floating offshore wind technology, you know, many miles of cabling and a lot more shipping traffic. And there is concern that that array of turbines that would be out there would impact wildlife in a number of ways. One is from whales, entanglement would be a huge issue. For birds, one impact of concern is just displacement. Birds may not want to go to those places that are impacted by the industry and would avoid those areas essentially. And the birds that do go in those areas would be, you know, susceptible to collision, striking the infrastructure, the turbines and other infrastructure out there. And that has been, you know, the case on land-based turbines for decades that we know of. So those are some of our major concerns.
All right. Thanks, you two, for helping me understand that.
Michael, there's actually, I mean, there are so many issues to express concern about it. I mentioned a couple, but one more I should also express that is going to come maybe more later in the process, but should be dealt with now, is the onshoring of the infrastructure. And there's concern about, you know, a lot of dredging and a lot of changing or a lot of building happening in certain places of that bay that could impact, for example, eelgrass beds. And a lot of that was brought out in the open with the Jordan Cove issue. And now it seems like they could be revisiting that if that infrastructure comes into Coos Bay.
Right. I mean, these are just massive proposals, and so there are so many considerations to take into account. I'm wondering if one of you can talk about where we go from here. What is the timeline, you know, from where we are now to these things actually being in operation? And then I also want to get into, as Joe mentioned, you know, there's a pretty broad set of groups from the fishing industry, state legislators, Coastal Caucus, conservationists, expressing a lot of these concerns. And from what I'm seeing, a lot of them are directed at the process itself and at BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. I wonder how genuine you think the community and stakeholder engagement that BOEM is doing is. And do you think it's enough? And what else should they be doing and looking at?
Sure. If I might, actually, I did want to rewind just a little bit with respect to the onshoring for Coos Bay. One of the reasons that Coos Bay has such great potential is because it also has the potential to avoid many of those impacts that Joe was talking about. There's an old paper mill outfall that exists there. So in terms of actually landing the transmission to shore, these old pipes that are in existence are really beautiful ways to very much limit any disturbances to get the electrons onshore to the points of interconnection. The other point I wanted to make, there are existing available spaces in industrial unused lands out on the North Spit that have 37.5 feet of existing depth. So it's not necessarily the case that offshore wind will result in deepening and widening the port. But moving on to the questions that you asked, I think the first was about timeline, what comes next, and then BOEM's process and the level of sincerity and any improvements. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you can take them together or separately.
Sure. So BOEM's about 3 years into their process. And frankly, the whole reason that Oregon Coast Energy Alliance Network, a new nonprofit down here on the coast, coalesced was because someone came from one of these federal meetings that was planning offshore wind off our coast and came back to Coos Bay and said, does anyone know what they're talking about? So that is a perfect example of ineffective outreach, right? These are the meetings they have had substantial meetings. They've done a tremendous amount of direct outreach to the identified leaders of those stakeholders that they've identified. Participation, however, requires that you not do whatever else you might be doing during your day job, that you're available to participate in the workshops that they host. So these are just systemic problems that definitely need to be updated. In terms of sincerity, I think they're very sincere and genuine and recognizing that there are serious limitations to the old MO for public outreach and are trying to very quickly improve upon them. So where we're at in our process now, it published draft call areas. We commented on them, back in December. They took the comments and as a result removed one of the call areas. In about 6 months, our wind energy areas will be defined. Those will be the basis of a lease we'll go to an auction. It goes to the highest bidder. Before that happens, we have an opportunity to help define what those lease provisions will be. So there's the timeline that we're in right now for civic action. After the leases at the end of 2003, there will be about 2 years of intense assessment and study that kind of starts to overlay around another 5 to 7 years of developing construction and operation plans and pursuing permits. The earliest we could have steel in the water, I'm told by industry members who have gone through this elsewhere, would be 2030, but more realistically, they're saying probably 2032.
Wow. Okay. So 10-year time horizon we're looking at. There's a lot of complexity and a lot of different stakeholders. Well, thanks for that overview. Joe, do you have anything to add maybe if you wanted to retouch on the programmatic EIS that you're asking for, because I think probably a lot of folks don't actually know what that is, or why it's important or would be important to do at least a broad one right at the beginning to look at cumulative impacts like you're talking about.
Sure. You know, we did have had multiple calls with BOEM, and so I should say that they've been very good about, you know, when we've asked to have a meeting with BOEM staff, they've readily done that. And I should also recognize that Shannon mentioned that they removed one of the call areas that we pushed hard for them to remove because it was over some really important rocky reef habitat. They did. That was, I think it was called the Bandon call area. So those are some, that's progress from our perspective that BOEM is listening to us. But there are concerns that they haven't listened to us. For example, on, we initially asked them, what were the criteria they used to establish the boundaries for the call areas? And they really couldn't give us a straight answer on that. And so that was really frustrating. At some level, we do know they're listening and taking our concerns into consideration. But on some of these big issues, like the programmatic EAS, they have yet to respond. And digging down into what that programmatic EIS is, it just sets in motion a process to examine how there could be impacts across call areas and across these wind energy areas that will be formed within the call areas that Shannon was talking about. And as Shannon mentioned, that the way it's set up now is that once there is a development bidded for and accepted, then there will be a really detailed, rigorous environmental assessment for that one place. But what we want really at the start of this process is for that to be done across multiple, all of the call areas on the West Coast. And we know that there's concern about that from some, that it will draw out the process longer, but in the long run, it actually may make the process more streamlined. Because if you reconcile some of these larger cumulative impact concerns now with the different stakeholders in a more transparent process, where you provide different alternatives of development scenarios to the public and to stakeholders, you may be able to get at those issues now and course correct and get those, get everybody on board now, and then later not have to deal with those issues. So that's our reason why we're really pushing that. This programmatic EIS, we really think BOEM should embrace that moving forward.
All right. Well, thanks for that. So as we wrap up, I wanted to ask each of you if there's anything that we didn't touch on, if you have any final thoughts, how folks can learn more about this issue and get involved, and how folks can get in touch with you all.
Sure. For folks that want to learn more about this issue, you know, you can go to the BOEM website for Oregon. You can just Google that and learn information directly from BOEM. But you can also reach out to me, Joe Liebesite, and my email, jliebesite, J-L-I-E-B-E-Z-E-I-T at audubonportland.org. And we can get you a lot of other information to get you up to speed on this issue, from mostly from the wildlife perspective. I'll leave it there and pass it over to Shannon.
Thanks. I would also encourage folks to go to the Oregon Department of Energy's website. Their staff is midway through a year-long evaluation of the opportunities and challenges of Oregon's floating offshore wind. So if you Google ODOE, offshore wind, you'll come up with that. Take a look at their slide decks from their three public meetings, the first two particularly. A lot of the information you're looking for is there. And one of the pieces of information that you will find is that while it would be lovely if we could meet our energy needs with microsolar, we need it all. We need rooftop solar, we need utility scale solar, we need more terrestrial wind, we're gonna see pump and storage, and we need a lot of offshore wind or nuclear. those truly are the options. But don't take my word for it. Check it out, see what the other agencies have to say about it. OCEAN is OregonEnergyAlliance.org if you're interested in connecting with other folks out on the coast that are looking at offshore wind, renewable hydrogen, solar microgrids, and other advanced clean energy technologies for the coast. And my name is Shannon, and you can email me, Shannon@SolCoast, SOLCOAST.com.
Great. And I will, for our podcast listeners, I'll include all those links and more in our show notes. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today. I really learned a lot, and I think it's so fascinating. So among many other titles and roles that these two both have, Joe Liebezeit is staff scientist for the Portland Audubon Society, and Shannon Souza is policy director for Pacific Ocean Energy Trust. Thank you both for joining me today. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Coast Range Radio today. You can find this and all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts or at our website, coastrange.org. That's coastrange.org. Please rate and review this show on your podcast app, tell a friend, and see show notes for more resources. I love hearing feedback and suggestions for future shows and guests, and you can email me at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at coastrange.org. That's our show. Thanks again, and talk to you soon.